evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Warren Allman. Allman is an adjunct associate professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. Since 1992, he has been the director of the Paleontological Research Institute, known as PRI, in Ithaca, New York. He has also been instrumental in planning and fundraising for the Museum of the Earth, PRI's education and exhibit facility, which opened in September of 2003. Welcome to the show, Warren.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you. Now, I want to begin at the beginning. Did you become interested in science as a boy, or did this start happening as you were going through your educational process?
I am told that I saw the Tyrannosaurus Rex in the American Museum of Natural History when I was three, and aside from a small detour into the Civil War when I was around 10, I've never wanted to do anything else.
Really? So the dinosaurs got you going.
There are, my old graduate advisor used to say that there are two kinds of paleontologists. One grew up in the country collecting fossils, the other grew up in the city looking at dinosaurs in museums, and I was the latter.
Oh, that's fascinating to me. So you were a professor of geology as well at the University of Florida. What made you get interested in the history of the Earth and so on?
Well, when I was a kid, it seems hard to believe now, but when I was a kid, it was actually kind of hard to find information about fossils and dinosaurs. There were a few books, and there were a few museums, of course, but it wasn't anything like it is now in terms of popular resources. So we moved to South Carolina when I was young from New York City, and my mother, bless her heart, spent a great deal of my childhood looking for those kinds of resources. We eventually found a college professor who was kind of an early mentor for me and gave us information about fossil hunting localities in South Carolina. And we spent a lot of my early teens as a family, I spent a lot of time dragging my poor parents to fossil hunting in the low country of South Carolina. And we did that when I was an early teenager. By then it was all over. I knew what I wanted to do. But that really taught me a lot of kind of practical things about the science, where before I had just kind of looked at museums.
That's fascinating that your parents were able to contribute to that desire.
Oh, it was absolutely. And even today.
Were you just picking up rocks in the yard, looking at them and going, Mom, I'm wondering what this meaning is.
And South Carolina is very different from New York State. The coast is very young rocks that are very fossiliferous, and that goes up to about the middle of the state, and then the rest of the state is the Piedmont and the Appalachians. There's no fossils at all, and we lived in the upstate, so we had to drive 3 or 4 hours down to the coast to get to the fossils, and that's why I love living in Ithaca, because, you know, if you spit out your car window here, you hit a fossil, and and every five-year-old has a box of travel bites here, and it just makes me crazy to think that when I was a kid, I would have cut off my arm to have one of these things that everybody here has so many of. We had to really work hard for the fossils that I collected when I was a kid.
Now, your major research interest, I was told, was macroevolution.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about what that even means.
Evolution is sometimes divided into macro and microevolution. Microevolution is, you can think of the kind of evolutionary change that you or I could see in our lifetime. So it's everything from antibiotic resistance in bacteria to agriculture. Agriculture is actually microevolution, cows giving more milk and larger corn and things like that. And macroevolution is, there are several definitions of it. It's sometimes called evolution above the species level, but a more general description of it would be it's evolution over long time spans. It's the evolution that a geologist can see. It's over hundreds of thousands to millions to tens to hundreds of millions of years. Now, the trick is, what's the connection between micro and macroevolution? Mm-hmm. And Charles Darwin got famous because he took the microevolution that everybody can see, that people who do agriculture and domesticated breeding can see, and he connected it to the macroevolution that you can see in the fossil record. And nobody has seriously questioned that. Nobody who knows anything has seriously questioned that since Darwin's death. It isn't visible. You can't see it happen today.
Mm-hmm.
You and I have to connect what we see in the chicken coop, essentially, or the lab dish, to what we see in the Grand Canyon, in the walls of the Grand Canyon, by inference. Now, that makes it sound kind of squishy. but all science depends on that extrapolation from what we do know to what we can't see directly. So macroevolution is the study of the grand sweep of time and what kinds of trends and patterns have developed over the history of life and why they've developed. So The classic case is horses used to be little and now they're big. How come? But that's just one of literally millions of examples. I work on marine mollusks as my favorite study material. They're a lot more common than horses in most places. And so I worry about things like, why are there so many species at a particular time? Why did a lot of those species go extinct at a particular time? How come there are a lot of these and not a lot of those? And the reason I say that I'm interested in macroevolution instead of that I'm interested in snails is because I just happen to work on snails. What I'm really interested in is, how does evolution work? What is that process that has led to the patterns that we see over long periods of geological time? I was describing this to somebody one time, and they said, so you're basically an evolutionary biologist that happens to look at dead things. And that's true. So a paleontologist who works on evolution is really an evolutionary biologist who just works on dead specimens.
Dead things.
That's right.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Very interesting profession. In 1992, you became the director of PRI. Was that hard for you to become an administrator instead of a researcher, or are you still doing both pretty much?
My old graduate advisor thought that I had gone into a black hole from which I would never emerge. The short answer is it's always difficult when an academic goes into administration, because that's not what we're trained to do. Mm-hmm. We're trained to value research over everything else, not practicality. We're supposed to talk about things, not actually accomplish them.
So why did you do this? Did you have a major motivation for doing this?
Unfortunately, I did. As interested as I am in macroevolution, I was also, apparently from an early age, really interested in a museum, in building a museum.
Ah.
And if I couldn't work in one, then I had to build one. And so the real reason I came here was, besides the fact I love the Northeast and missed the seasons living in Florida, I knew that Ithaca was really one of the last great opportunities to build a major natural history museum in the United States. And what I mean by that is that PRI has been here since 1932. The collection actually dates back far beyond that, dates back to the beginning of Cornell University. And so here is this enormous collection. It's somewhere in the top 10 largest fossil collections in the United States, but it didn't have a public museum with it. It had no public exhibit and education programs. And if you were the richest person in the world and you wanted to build a museum, you could not duplicate the collection that we have at PRI. And that's because it goes back more than 100 years. Many of the localities where those things came from are long gone, flooded, paved, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so a collection is the core of a natural history museum. For all that we've done over the last 15 years at PRI, I always tell people that the most expensive, difficult part of building the Museum of the Earth was done before I was born. And that's absolutely
amazing, isn't
true.
It?
It's absolutely true. So I knew that this collection was here. I actually came here to use the collection when I was a graduate student. And I knew the collection was here, and I knew that it was next to a great university, and I knew that there were lots of fossils in central New York, and I knew that there was an opportunity here that probably wasn't available in lots of other places. Did I know what I was getting into? Probably not.
So were you in on the beginning discussions about starting the Museum of the Earth, and where did that actually come from?
Well, many of your listeners may remember the name Ray Van Hout. Ray was the president of the Tompkins Trust Company for many years, and he retired about the time I got to town. And he had been on the board of PRI at that time for more than a decade. And Ray, for reasons that I never really got from him before he died, Ray had a special interest, a special place in his heart for PRI. He wasn't obviously a paleontologist; he was a banker, but he thought there was something else there besides the pile of fossils.
Mm.
And so when I arrived, he made it his mission to see what PRI could accomplish. And so actually it was Ray Van Hout who said to the PRI board in 1994, I had been here just a couple of years, he said, we should embark on a bold task here. We might fail, but we should try it. And we should build a museum. And he held a document that was an economic development study of the Southern Tier that had been done in the late 1980s, and it said that the central sub-region of the Southern Tier, which is, I guess, bureaucratic speak for Ithaca, as opposed to Cooperstown and Corning, should invest in educational tourism and educational infrastructure to complement its educational institutions. Mm-hmm. And Cooperstown has a great big museum community, and Corning has a great big museum community. How come Ithaca doesn't have a great big museum community? Now, you have to remember, this was before the Science Center, this was before mm-hmm. the Lab mm-hmm. of Ornithology building, and so forth.
But you must have been thrilled.
Well, I was. I was thrilled to have somebody like Ray say, this is a good idea.
Yeah.
I was even more thrilled when he got Senator Jim Seward interested. And that resulted a few years later in $2 million as a seed fund to get us going. $1 million from the state of New York through Jim Seward's office, and $1 million from the Park Foundation.
Mm.
And it was that core of funds that allowed the museum really to get off the ground. And that was in 96, and we opened 7 years later. But it was really Ray's vision of economic development around education
mm-hmm.
that was the impetus. All I did was say, I have the stuff to show in the museum.
Wow, that's an incredible story.
It is. It's
all
quite
this came together at the same time. All the money was available.
It was a great decade to build museums.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I want to talk to you also about the fact that you've published some articles that are of interest to me. In 1995, you published a piece called Mass Extinction, So What? And in 1997, you published a piece called Learning from History, Mass Extinction in the Past, Present, and Future. To talk to us about.
Wow, you did burrow into my CD.
The ideas of extinction.
Well,
it seems to be accelerating.
Oh, there's no question about that.
No,
there's no question
yeah.
about that. And any of your listeners who've been to the museum will see that mass extinction is one of the themes of the exhibits at the museum. And that's because mass extinction in the last 20 years has become known as a major theme in the history of life. So everybody knows that the dinosaurs became extinct 65 mm-hmm. million years ago. And most people are aware that most scientists think that a big rock fell out of the sky 65 million years ago. Most people are not aware that mass extinction is actually a pretty common phenomenon in the history of life, and that it's happened many times, and that it's a real shaper of the history of life. So, for example, if a really good local example here is if you just pick up one of the gray rocks around Ithaca and try to identify the fossil animals you see in it, they will be very, very different groups of animals than you would find if you go to Cape Cod for spring break.
Hmm. Hmm.
And that difference was accomplished by a mass extinction about 250 million years ago that killed off maybe 90% of all life in the seas.
Do we know what caused that? Because now it's being caused by human touch, isn't it?
We're just learning what that particular event probably was caused by a number of different things. It may have been an extraterrestrial impact. It may have been sea level change. It may have been volcanism. But all of these events of mass extinction have in common that they don't just remove some creatures and leave the world without whatever has gone extinct. So a mass extinction that killed off the dinosaurs isn't the world without dinosaurs. Mass extinction mm-hmm. takes away so much of the species, so many of the species, such a large proportion, that it leaves the world a qualitatively different place afterwards. And that's the significance mm-hmm. of it. And what paleontology can tell us is that you can't necessarily predict from looking at who might be well adapted prior to a mass extinction, who's going to make it through it. And now we come to the present. What are the implications? So if you study the fossil record of mass extinction and look at the present, what can we gain from that? And the short answer is that there's no question we're in the middle of a mass extinction episode. And the only question is how big it's going to be. Estimates range from 10 to 50% in the next 500 years.
Good heavens.
That's right. And it is so nothing like that has happened on this Earth in 65 million years. So why is that interesting? Well, the fossil record tells us that will leave the biosphere, the living world, not just a place without panda bears and gray whales. It will be a qualitatively different biosphere. Now, what does that mean? Well, we don't know. It will remove such large quantities of species wholesale out of the biosphere that we can't predict. No scientist could predict what the biosphere is going to look like. And is that a bad thing? Well, we probably will not want to live in the world after that event has occurred.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Warren Allman. He's the director of PRI and the Museum of the Earth. Is there any way, talking about extinction, to prevent any of this, or has it accelerated to such a rate that it's out of our hands?
Well, if I knew that, I would be out on the speaking circuit. We don't know.
You don't know.
That's, first of all, it's not my field, but it's the same question that people ask about global warming. And for that matter, it's the same question people ask about peak oil, which is another phrase that people say. Mm. Are we there yet? Well, we won't actually know until it's too late.
Until we get there, yeah.
And it is really important to think about the geological record as a source of insight to try to answer that question. Mm. Because we can't do experiments in the historical sciences. We can't do an experiment to demonstrate how the Grand Canyon formed or how dinosaurs became extinct. We can only look for natural experiments. And so the geological record has those natural experiments, and we can try to learn from them. And what we've learned about mass extinction is that it can happen in a variety of different ways, at a variety of different rates, for a variety of different causes, but it always leaves a qualitatively different world.
And all we can do is sit back and watch. Now, I want to segue a little bit. You got very involved in the debate about evolution and creationism teaching in the schools. Tell us about that. There were articles about you in the papers in the Washington Post.
Well, actually, it's kind of a funny story. Again, if you've been to the museum, you notice that evolution is not an afterthought. At least I hope people notice. Evolution's not an afterthought in the Museum of the Earth exhibits. It's a main theme, and that was absolutely on purpose. But we were so busy with all these other things that were associated with opening the museum in 2003 and 2004 that we didn't forget. We just didn't get around to one of the most important things that we had intended to do, which was to train the volunteers that work on the floor of the museum. And again, if you've been to the museum, you will almost always see one or more volunteer docents on the floor. And those people are not just folks that walked in that morning. Those are people who have said they want to volunteer, and they've actually gone through a training program. And the training programs that we offer our volunteers are in all kinds of different subjects so that they can learn more and more and have a rich experience for themselves. But we also want to focus on particular topics that are of interest to many visitors. And so evolution, we knew, was going to be one of those, but we hadn't gotten around to it. Mm-hmm. And one of our best, most experienced docents had the following experience. One day she was in the museum on the museum floor, and a group of visitors, as she put it, surrounded her and essentially confronted her. And they were creationists, and they challenged her to explain and defend lots of evolutionary ideas. And the next funny part of the story is that this particular volunteer happens to be a retired biology professor.
Ooh.
So she at least was equipped to deal with most of the questions, but she was very uncomfortable by the experience. And they kept her there for 45 minutes, and she finally had to literally excuse herself and just escape. So she came and told us, the staff, about this experience, and she said, I think, you know, if I had not known as much as I know, she said, I wouldn't have been able to deal with this. So wouldn't you run some training programs? So that was the beginning of our volunteer training effort, mm-hmm. and that was in middle or late 2004. So we began to run these volunteer training programs, and eventually the word got to the New York Times that this had happened, that this episode had happened, and that we had these training programs. And much to my amazement, we are, as far as I know, the only museum in the United States that has, or at that time, had an explicit training program for its docents in evolution, in how to answer visitor questions about evolution.
Hmm.
And that led
perfect
to this
timing.
It was quite remarkable timing. And so that led to this article in the New York Times in September of 2005. And of course, that was the time when the Dover trial was going on in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And anything having to do with anything around creationism and evolution was in the news. And so we got this very tiny niche of the intelligent design controversy, so-called, became ours. And since then, we've begun to develop programs for other museums. in how to train their docents, even some very large museums, zoos, aquaria, etc. We have worked with BOCES and Cornell's K-12 outreach programs to train teachers. We just had a workshop last week, as a matter of fact. And we're beginning to become a player in New York State and in the Northeast in responding to the very real need that teachers have for just practical advice. How do you teach this stuff? How do you talk about this stuff in the classroom? And it all came out of training our docents on the museum floor.
That's quite incredible, for especially the timing. Are you amazed that science has become so politicized and focused on religion?
Am I amazed?
Yeah.
No. Am I horrified?
Yes. It seems to have happened actually more in the last few years, obviously.
It's quite extraordinary.
We have a government that's encouraging this kind of anti-science, it is.
I won't go down the political path. You have lots of other guests that do that. But it is quite remarkable in two areas that are within my field of expertise, in global warming and in evolution. These are not unimportant areas. And what you call the politicization of science has had devastating, really, really important effects on those two fields.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I should just say that we have no way of knowing what's true in science except to compare it to observations about the physical world. Well, not every scientist and not every person can make all the observations and do all the experiments and do all the hypothesis testing. So how do you and I actually decide what's scientifically
believable?
True? What's believable?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
It's called most scientists think. And while science isn't democratic, we don't vote on the truth in science, we kind of do. We basically say, let's get all the smart people in the room who work on this particular question, who have expertise in this question, who've worked on comparing aspects of the physical world to hypotheses and testing them. And then we essentially say, what do you folks think? What do most of you think? And that becomes what we think is quote unquote true. Now, that doesn't make it true. But it's the system that we've used for the past 300 years to figure out.
So you don't see scientific debates segueing into religious questions, huh? When you say a group of scientists get together, the smartest minds to discuss these issues, does anybody segue into religion?
Of course, because both science and religion are central human interests.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you can try to keep things separate in your life, right? But you can't keep your personal life out of anything, right? So, since religion is very important to almost everybody one way or the other, of course it washes into scientific issues. And there's actually renewed interest now. There's a spate of very interesting books out now by practicing scientists about their religious ideas, their religious feelings. It's actually a fascinating topic. Unfortunately, it's very easy to take that topic and soundbite it and make it into, as you say, a politicized topic. And that, of course, is what happened with intelligent design, is that it got soundbited by people who didn't know anything, and led to the famous presidential soundbite. And those things really matter.
Oh, they do.
And with global warming, it could matter with truly cataclysmic consequences. With evolution, it's not going to lead to, you know, the flooding of New York City, but it's going to lead to, already has led to, the dumbing down of science education in America, which has very important economic and social consequences. I don't want to sound like Chicken Little or anything, but the politicization of science is not just about a bunch of scientists whining that nobody's listening to them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about what is the role of science in modern society, and if you don't take the advice of scientists, those group of people in the room, what do you do? What's the alternative?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people were shocked by the, frankly, dumbing down of so many school boards in this country by people who are voting on the fact that evolution shouldn't be taught. Can you, in just a couple sentences, tell us what you say to people who come into the museum and ask whether it's true that there's evidence against evolution?
What we suggest to our docents, who are the people who meet most of the visitors, we say, evolution is as widely accepted as anything else in science that we think is quote-unquote true, like the Earth going around the sun, like matter being made of atoms, like bacteria causes disease. Evolution is as well-founded and as well-documented as any of those ideas. It is very close to true as we understand truth to be. Now, that doesn't mean we understand everything about how it works, quite the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
But is evolution true? I don't know. Is it well supported by essentially every piece of science we've found in the last 150 years? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's just a statement of the way science is. That's mm-hmm. And again, that gets back to the understanding of what science is. Science is not truth. Science is an approach to understanding the physical world. And evolution, meaning that organisms are connected genealogically and have changed through time, if evolution isn't true, then we don't understand the fundamental nature of the physical world, because every single observation we make demands that evolution be true.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most common question we get in the museum is, isn't there a lot of evidence against evolution, or don't a lot of scientists doubt that evolution has happened? And the reason they say that, of course, is that somebody has told them that. I almost don't know what to say. When somebody says that, you have to just say, well, actually, there is no evidence against evolution. And what I mean by that is there is not a single piece of credible evidence that anybody in the relevant disciplines worries about that has caused any scientist to question whether there's a problem. And you say, well, wait a minute, I've heard about these PhDs who don't believe in evolution. You know, they're smart. How come? Well,
people call it the theory of evolution.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
I mean, it's just a theory. That's right. It's just
you learn that in school, the theory of evolution.
But
yeah.
Think about this. I mean, I'm a fairly intelligent guy, according to some people, but I'm not sure you'd want to take my advice on, say, cancer treatment. I mean, I have a PhD, so does that give me the right to comment on every question of science?
Mm.
I don't think so.
I understand what you mean, yeah.
And so if you just take a poll of all the PhDs in the country, or even all the science PhDs, how many believe in evolution? And if 20% of them or 50% of them raise their hand, but all those are people not in the relevant disciplines, then it really doesn't mean that much. It's like polling paleontologists about cancer treatment. So that's a really important point.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, there are books out there, there's websites out there that say, intellectuals who dissent against evolution, or scientists who dissent against evolution. Sure, there's engineers and food scientists and hydrologists and so forth. Nothing against those disciplines, but I wouldn't go to them for evolution, and the same way I wouldn't come to me for cancer.
Cancer treatment. I understand that. As a scientist, do you wander into the spiritual realms and have come to any conclusions about spirituality, or do you stay grounded with your earth science? I asked Steve Squires this as well.
At the risk of reinforcing every stereotype of scientist, I'll ask you to define wander and spirituality.
the supposition that there is a God, perhaps.
Science, as a matter of just definition, science, in my view, can have no opinion, no scientific opinion, about the existence of something that is supernatural, by definition. Science is about the non-supernatural. Getting back to what we talked about earlier, I cannot personally separate the science part of my head from the non-science part of my head, and anybody who says they can is lying. Do I personally have those kinds of thoughts? No. I personally see no evidence for it and see no need for it. Does that mean I know that it does not exist? I have thought about that for many, many years, and I have finally come to peace with the conclusion that, no, I cannot say that it does not exist, and I don't think any scientist can. Lots of scientists do. Lots of best-selling books do. But and I think that's really important for scientists to say, that science is about what science is about, and science isn't about what it isn't about. It's about the physical world. And we're pretty darn sure we understand the physical world pretty well, but we can't say we understand the supernatural.
Mm-hmm. Warren Allman, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.